session number 24729.
Mr. Mason, Real 2. We're talking about your time with the 4th Battalion, Northamptonshire Regiment, at Aldershot from October 1939 onwards. And you say you were made unwelcome because these people... Could you explain in what way you perhaps felt unwelcome?
Well, I've been in the intelligence section of the headquarters battalion, headquarters company of the 5th Battalion. The intelligence section of the 4th Battalion was made up of an architect and his staff, who had all joined the TA, as I say, to avoid being conscripted. And they didn't want an outsider.
So you weren't put in the intelligence section?
No, I was made a simple infantryman.
Which company, do you remember?
It would still be headquarters company. But I imagine I was probably sent to the Bren gun section, because I got into trouble there in that a sergeant started instructing us on the Bren gun, and unfortunately I knew more about it than he did. So I was considered... a bit of a drag on the market, and I was put on cookhouse fatigues.
Now, which... Tell us about the cookhouse fatigues. Well, what were cookhouse fatigues?
When this happened, I'm really jumping a little ahead, because while they were at Aldershot, they got rid of me most of the time. I worked as an orderly at one of the headquarters in Aldershot. They had to supply a bod to, you know...
Well, tell me about that first.
Well, right? That was a simple business of keeping the fire alight and answering the telephone. And it was a sort of 24-hour duty where I think I alternated with another bod where you spent 24 hours... keeping the office running, basically, and sweeping up and doing everything.
An orderly clerk.
Orderly. And then they moved, the battalion were moved to Northampton.
Do you know when that was?
And that would be, I would think, within about a month. So we're probably talking about the end of October, beginning of November. And as I say, I there found myself on cookhouse fatigues because they didn't think I needed any training, which was quite good because I knew Wellingborough in that I used to go there playing rugby. And I
you went to Wellingborough, not Northampton. Sorry,
Wellingborough. Yes, sorry. We moved to Wellingborough. Into the drill hall there, which was just a large hall where we slept on the floor. And
what were the cookhouse fatigues like? Well, what did you actually have to do?
Well, basically, you got up and stoked the fires up and got everything organised while the cooks cooked, and then. Spent most of the morning, half the morning peeling spuds and getting things ready for the lunch. You washed up all the gear after lunch and then you were free, which was very handy because I used to go down to the Hind Hotel, which I knew, and occasionally spend a spell in the library, which was improving. And it wasn't a bad life, but this only went on for...
Can I just ask, why didn't they make you an NCO? Because, I mean, that would have seemed to be the obvious way out of the problem, would it be make you an NCO so you could instruct people?
Well, they had their NCOs. I mean, their NCOs were people who had joined the DA and had been made an NCO overnight, because they'd all started from scratch. And so, as I say, I wasn't entirely welcome, because they had all their systems set up. Until one day in December, about, let me see, it would be about the 20th of December, probably. I was called from my cookhouse fatigues and told the colonel wanted to see me. Well, I'd never even seen the colonel, and I couldn't imagine what I'd done wrong. But when I tidied myself up and went to see the colonel, he said, I've been asked to send someone to brigade headquarters, which is just being formed, for their intelligence section. And he said, I'll be honest, you're the only man I dare send. And so I was posted off to Tewkesbury, where they were forming the brigade, 183 Brigade Headquarters, in a hotel in Tewkesbury. And they were going to run an intelligence course, and they were going to have, their intelligence section would consist of the intelligence officer, a sergeant, a corporal, and a lance corporal. And I was the prospective lance corporal.
So, acting unpaid at first?
Oh, no.
You didn't actually...
I never had an acting unpaid rank in my life.
So, did they actually make you a lance corporal?
Not until I did the course.
Now, what was the course? Tell me what the course was.
Well, before the course, I got there, and they said, we're not going to do the course until after Christmas. It would probably be the end of January. But you don't want to go back to your unit, do you? And I said, well, not really. They said, well, perhaps you can do something. If you wouldn't mind being an orderly for the time being, what can you do? And I said, well, you know, what do you want? They said, we don't suppose you could work a telephone switchboard. And I said, well, I used to work one in the office. And they said, well, come and have a look. And I said, oh, yes, that's similar to the one I used to work. And they were delighted, because they had been having a signals man ride a motorbike all the way from Birmingham to Tewkesbury every day to work the switchboard. And that really involves another story, because my wife-to-be was a telephone operator in Tewkesbury Exchange. And they, once war started, they worked through the night, which in peacetime they didn't do. So I was on 24-hour duty at the telephone, and so I spent half the night talking to telephone operators. I was allowed to go to the pub next door and have a drink, and if the telephone rang, an orderly would be sent to fetch me.
How did these switchboards work in those days? Can you just describe very simply how they worked?
Well, they were
people
quite,
don't know now.
These were quite simple little things with a row of holes at the top where if it rang, a sort of ball came down, and a row of little knobs, and you just put the incoming down one down and put the one down on the telephone that you wanted it to go to. And they were very simple, actually. Very
simple.
Could
you deal with more than one call at a time?
I think this only had one line. I know the one in the office had two. It may have had two, but I've got an idea it only had one line, but you've got, you know, about 10 extensions, something like that.
So if someone was on the phone, that was it?
Yes, yes, yes. And
now, so you're doing this for a while. It sounds like it would be relatively easy to train someone to do this. I don't know, I hope, but...
Well, I did this for about 3 weeks or a month, and then we did the course, which was run by the brigade intelligence officer, who was a Captain Wake, a Captain Harrywood Wake, who had been a master at Cheltenham College. Very nice fella. We did studied German uniforms, German formations, and this really was the same sort of thing as I'd been doing initially in the 5th Battalion. And the difference was we had more open air work in that the brigade used to run TOOTS, which is Tactical Exercises Without Troops. And so the intelligence section used to go out and go over the land and provide the brigade major, whoever was running it, with a map which showed every hazard and detail, whereas the officers who were doing the exercise just had an ordinary one-inch map. And this was the main sort of thing that we did. And that went on until Dunkirk time.
So you were there from essentially, well, you got there, you did the course in January. Were you promoted after the course?
Oh yes, I became a Lance Corporal, fully paid up Lance Corporal. Yes.
Did that make much of a difference to life?
Not really, because, you know, I hadn't got any troops to command or anything like that. And I didn't really make any difference at all.
So nothing much happened. You stayed at Tewkesbury, basically doing this sort of training.
Yes.
And then, of course, yes, providing maps to the Tews until Dunkirk, end of May.
Beginning of May, we moved to Bishop's Cleeve. And at the time of Dunkirk, general panic started, and whereas we hadn't bothered to have a guard on the brigade headquarters, we had a sergeant and a platoon of the Worcestershire Regiment come and run a guard. And very funny, really, because they insisted that we must have a guard to hand over to the new guard. And we hurriedly had to read up all the instructions. And I was put in charge of the guard, who were being brigade headquarters, cooks and butchers and orderlies, and hand over the guard to the smartest sergeant that the Worcestershire Regiment could send, with a dozen of the smartest men they could find to show off to brigade headquarters. And you can imagine this was quite an ordeal.
You just had to do it there once, did you?
Only once, yes. Once it was handed over to them, it was theirs.
And did it go reasonably well, or...?
Well, better than one would expect, but it was, you know, like showing a shiny new saucepan a dirty old frying pan.
Any other effects of that?
They had been trained up to come and do this. And then, of course, with all the troops coming back from France, we were posted to Northern Ireland. We went over at the end of
June.
About the end, well, it would be by the end of June, I would imagine. And we went to Belfast, and the brigade headquarters was made the Belfast headquarters, and the battalions were scattered around Belfast.
So where were you in Belfast? Sorry.
Oh dear, we were up in North Belfast.
Well, Belfast will do. Yeah.
And I can't think of the name of the place. We were really on an old Greyhound track.
What exactly were you doing while you were there?
Well, my job then was liaison with the police, the Home Guard. And I used to ride around on a commandeered motorcycle and visit all the Home Guard commanders and various police stations.
Now, what kind of liaison? Do you see what I mean? What were you doing?
Well, our main problem was whether we'd have any trouble with the IRA, who were inclined to knock over the odd soldier occasionally. And sentries had to be posted in pairs because singly they would nick the rifle and lay out the sentry, so that it was a little bit edgy. We didn't have a great deal of.
And what were you getting the police and Home Guard to do? Just. How would they liaise with you?
Well, it was mainly what were they doing, what could we do to help them, and build up a coordinated defence scheme. Though one couldn't see the Germans landing in Belfast, but we. Stayed there for about 3 months, I should think, and then went out to Cookstown, the other side of Loch Nay. And as troops were now available, more troops were coming over to Northern Ireland. Obviously, the intention was that we should be available should Germans land in the south of Ireland, which was thought to be very probable, that it, you know, it was an easier way perhaps of getting at us than crossing the Channel.
That was taken seriously.
Oh yes.
Were there any border defences put in place or anything? What sort of plans were there?
No, we didn't really add to border defences. We weren't really there to defend the border. We were there to dash smartly into Southern Ireland and protect them and protect us.
So the idea was to defend on the coast of the area, Southern Ireland?
Yeah.
And so what exactly, were you still doing liaison work? Or?
Well, no, then we'd settle down to sort of normal battalion, infantry battalion procedures. And
Were you still attached to headquarters?
I was still on the brigade headquarters. Yes.
And what sort of billets were you in?
An old laundry, I think it was, which was the biggest building in Cookstown. And
what were conditions like there?
Well, not very good, but I remember we had bunk beds crammed into the biggest room they could find, and
how did you get on with the Irish yourselves? I mean, I know there was threat from the IRA, but how did you find the Irish people?
Oh, they were friendly enough, but on the other hand, of course, you didn't know what they said when you weren't there, and there was a little bit. Belfast was easy because it was split into areas. Some areas you didn't go into, and the areas you went into, people were on your side anyway. Cookstown was a bit different because you had one main street, and you knew that half the people didn't want you and the other half did, and you didn't know which were which.
And anything else happened while you were in Cookstown? You got there about September, I would...
Not a lot. It was a rather dull time. And then really we go on to the next phase when they published orders which said that as the RAF were short of pilots, they were asking for volunteers from the army. Now, I tried on several times through several people to get a transfer to the Air Force, but it had never got anywhere. And I immediately volunteered. I had a little bit of discussion because Captain Wake said, well, the Brigadier won't like it, but he said, I will see if I can sort of push the thing through while he's not looking. And so eventually I got a summons to Belfast to the RAF recruiting office, and they said, why do you want to join the RAF? And I said, because if the war had started a fortnight later, I'd have been in the RAF.
As a regular.
And they said, that's very interesting, and so I was accepted. And on the 1st of January, I transferred to the RAF.
Now, where did you have to go?
I had to report to what they called a reception centre at Stratford-on-Avon, which was, we were billeted in a hotel, which was quite pleasant. There were about 40 of us on the first. I was on the first course. My number was 655034, which meant I was the 34th person to transfer. Our first problem was that we had collars and ties, which meant that we all had to run across the road to Woolworths and get some studs. And the idea was, of course, that the time would be shortened because we could then be sent straight to an ITW instead of having any
ITW
initial training wing, instead of having to do any sort of marching about or anything of this sort. While we were at Stratford, we used to form up outside the hotel in the morning, and a sergeant used to march us round the corner and then say, so I'll sort of bugger off and be back at 12.
You'd all come from the army, so you were pre-trained.
Yes, and you lost your rank. You were all LACs and cadets, so you had a little white flash in your cap. And you were all equal rank, though, of course.
What was the status of cadets? So, you were going to be officers, was that the idea? Or
well, you were going to be aircrew. You were aircrew cadets, so you were either going to be an officer or a sergeant. And you did nothing, really, but your training. You know, you weren't sent off on odd jobs or anything like that.
Before, you'd been going to sign up as a pilot, and then you were going to be an observer. Had they spotted you were going to be an observer?
No, I've still got to be a pilot. So we went from Strap. We were
Nothing much happened there. I mean, it was just a reception centre.
At Stratford, we just collected uniforms and things like that.
So remember the uniforms you got? What did they kit you out with? How did it compare to your army gear?
Well, the main difference was you had a collar and tie, and your tunic was quite smart compared with what you had in the army. And otherwise, you know, virtually the same. Your clothes generally were the same sort of standard, but a much smarter appearance to them. Then after we were only there about a fortnight, and then we went to Scarborough to the ITW.
Do you know which one? Do you know the number? Do you know the number, ITW?
Oh, gosh.
I don't think it's in here, is it, in your logbook?
No, the ITW number won't be there.
All right, well, they can look it up, yeah.
Scarborough, where, we were in a hotel, and we did the initial things like aircraft recognition, a bit
now
of...
How did that take them through one at a time, you know. How did they teach you aircraft recognition? I mean, what was the method they employed?
Well, you looked at pictures and models and you know, picked them out. But, of course, this was something that I'd done in my intelligence section training before. Aircraft recognition was one of the things that was included in that. And so, in fact, in the exam at the end of the ITW training, I passed at least five people, myself and the fellow there.
They copied off you. Now, what other training? Aircraft recognition? What else?
Maps and charts. You do something on maps and charts.
Was that easy enough for you?
Oh, yes, because I've been using maps again for all the time I've been in the army.
Did they bring any sort of more navigational element into it, you know, as opposed to interpreting from a map?
I don't think we did any actual navigation. We probably only sort of played about with charts. It was mainly simple things, what an aeroplane looked like, and it was just to prepare you for going to a flying school and give you some background on what it was all about.
Anything else? Aircraft recognition maps? Anything else?
No, there must have been something else, but I can't remember much else.
How did you fit in with the squad, the other chaps?
Oh, we were... Well, of course, we were all very pleased with ourselves, having transferred from the army. And we got on very well together. It was a very happy crowd.
No bullying?
Oh, no. Or anyone pulling rank, although, you know, we had sergeant majors and things who were...
Within the group?
Who had been reduced to simple LACs.
They lost their rank.
Oh, yes. But they, you know, they wanted to go to the Air Force. So they were all keen types, obviously.
Were you aware of RAF casualties, you know, especially bomber command, things like that?
Not overall, but of course by then some of the people I'd been at school with had already gone, and of course this was the way fate was very kind to me. If I started navigation training in 1939, it's highly unlikely that I would have finished the war, so that I'd really been dealt a good card, although I didn't think so at the time. But I've been spared the initial cack-handiness of the Air Force in the first few months of the war.